From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is set to make an announcement at the White House later this afternoon, as it's expected to be an executive order connected to the administration's efforts to include a citizenship question in the 2020 census, something the Supreme Court temporarily blocked. Meanwhile, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, may arrest thousands of undocumented family members in the United States this weekend. Joining us to talk about all of this is NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Hi, Franco.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. And let's start with the announcement this afternoon. What are you hearing about what the president may say when it comes to the citizenship question on the census?
Right. So my sources tell me that the president is expected to announce an executive action to put the citizens' question back in the census. It is an effort of his to do it. How that would actually materialize, we're a little unclear. One way to do that would be to kind of execute a memorandum kind of outlining the policy changes that the Trump administration would like to pursue. The president's just not backing down on this, as we know.
Even though the Supreme Court, as we said, temporarily blocked the administration's attempt to do this.
Correct. I mean, this is something that President Trump is clearly not willing to give up. He is not ready to go down without a fight. And we shall see. You know, there were a lot of talk about whether he would do an executive order, which would be a lot more sweeping. This is not that. This is not expected to be that. This would be an executive action. So we got some more reporting to do to kind of figure out what specifically it'll mean.
And of course, we will hear from the president later today. And he will answer some of our questions. Meanwhile, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, talked about the census issue at a press conference this morning and said this about some Trump administration officials, including Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, who was the one trying to get the citizenship question on the census in the first place.
Next week, the full House will vote on a resolution of criminal contempt for Attorney General Barr and Secretary Ross so we can enforce our subpoenas and get the facts.
So criminal contempt, she says. What does that mean? And do Democrats have any real power to respond here to whatever the president does today?
Yeah, I mean, it means that the Democrats really want to keep the pressure on Barr, on Ross, on the administration on this issue for defying these congressional subpoenas. You know, I'm not really sure what tangible impact this would have being held contempt, though. Certainly it doesn't look good for the Trump administration. That said, the Justice Department just is not likely to charge the Attorney General with any kind of crime. The DOJ is already urging officials not to comply with these subpoenas.
Okay, let's talk about the other big story, and it's coming up this weekend. Immigration advocates are expecting raids by Immigration and Customs Enforcement to start this weekend, but the Department of Homeland Security officials have not commented to NPR about the timing. What exactly do we know?
Well, we do know that immigration advocates are preparing for these raids starting on Sunday. Obviously the administration had talked about these before, focusing on 10 cities, major cities, where they're going to be targeting thousands of migrant parents and children with final orders of removal. The administration did tell me before that they're looking at the million people, these are their numbers, here who they say are here legally, who have final orders of deportation, and they want to enforce those orders.
Now, as you said, they did threaten this before, the administration did, and then they delayed it. Remind us why that happened.
Yeah, it was 2 weeks ago. President Trump tweeted out that he was going to hold off on these sweeps at the request of Democrats. He said he was going to do it to give lawmakers more time to change some of the asylum rules that he and some Republicans have been seeking. That was 2 weeks ago. Nothing really has changed on that front. Frankly, nothing was expected to change on that front. This is such an emotional and difficult issue. Democrats have long opposed what the Trump administration is seeking, which is to make it easier for border agents, enforcement agents, to quickly turn back those arriving who claim to have a credible fear and to try to get more deeper into the asylum process.
Franco, I want to ask you about one more thing, which is Labor Secretary Alex Acosta gave this press conference yesterday about how he handled the case of Jeffrey Epstein back in 2008 when he was a U.S. attorney in Florida. Acosta has been sharply criticized for a much lighter sentence that was put on Epstein back then. Many have called for Acosta's resignation. How did the White House respond to what Acosta did in his press conference yesterday?
The White House has been largely mum on specifically on the press conference. President Trump has yet to say anything publicly. This will certainly be asked this afternoon, I would expect, if the opportunity arises. His Twitter account time also has been kind of quiet. But the president is standing behind his labor secretary, at least right now. He's praising the secretary's work, but he's also saying that he's going to look closely at this matter. You know, we have been in this situation before with other top officials, mm-hmm. Health and Human Secretary Tom Price, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke.
Right.
So a lot to find out.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, on the southern border, the number of asylum seekers from Central America is straining federal border agencies, nonprofit organizations, local towns. Along Arizona's border with Mexico, the Trump administration is building more places to hold migrants. But it's also increasing pressure on a neighboring Mexico border city because of the administration policy known as Remain in Mexico that requires asylum seekers wait in Mexico for court dates. From the Fronteras desk at KJZZ in Phoenix, Michelle Marisco reports.
The U.S. Border Patrol spent $15 million to turn a parking lot at its vast Yuma sector headquarters in Arizona into a gleaming white tent compound. With temperatures topping 110 degrees, massive air conditioners loudly blast 60-degree air through the tents to cool them as the agency awaited the first group of migrants.
Depending on the amount of people that are in here, it's going to depend on how hard the system's going to work.
Agency spokesman Desi De Leon shows a group of reporters the compound. There are tents for sleeping, new cots stacked against a wall, and areas where migrants will be checked in and fed.
The cold meal is a turkey sandwich, chips, and fruit, and either some kind of juice. So
they'll also receive two hot meals a day and snacks. Outside, workers used a forklift to maneuver a washing machine into another tent.
We're washing their clothes and providing them something that's available to all of us that we would like to have as human beings, really. So.
The facility is designed to hold 500 families and lone children and went up as the Border Patrol was slammed by allegations that it mistreated children at its Clint, Texas facility. Asylum seekers are allowed to stay for up to 3 days, and then under President Donald Trump's controversial Remain in Mexico policy, will return to Mexico to await their asylum court hearing. It's a policy deemed unsafe for non-Mexican asylum seekers as violence hopscotches along Mexico's border cities.
Remain in Mexico has certainly further destabilized an already unstable situation.
Ariana Sawyer is with the advocacy group Human Rights Watch. She worries Central Americans will be targeted by drug cartels while they wait. She says that's already happened in other border cities. She says she spoke with one mother who was kidnapped in Ciudad Juarez for a ransom.
I mean, the man told her he'd kill her if he didn't get the money, which ended up being about $800.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection has been criticized for bottlenecking asylum seekers at the border, limiting the number of asylum seekers allowed to enter the U.S., a process called metering. Yuma Sector Chief Anthony Porvaznik says CBP had no choice.
I think the ports of entry have to do some metering because they do have their job that they have to. They're responsible for legitimate trade and travel, and they only have so many people to do that job, and so they can only process so many people that are coming in to claim asylum or credible fear.
Across the border in San Luis Rio Colorado, Mexico, Martin Salgado plucks an old blue book sitting askew on a shelf and held together with scotch tape. He and his staff at Mexico's Casa de Migrantes painstakingly note the names of new arrivals trying to head north. It's the only official record either country has of who is trying to cross to ask for asylum in the U.S. The people here are predominantly from Mexico, but also
Venezuela, Guatemala, Nicaragua, Colombia, Haiti,
His shelter was intended for deportees to stay for a short while, not for U.S. asylum seekers expecting to wait for months.
Pues primero Dios, estamos unidos.
Irles Vega says she hopes to God to arrive to the U.S., but she and her son have already waited in Mexico 2 months just to ask for asylum, the result of that metering. Under the Remain in Mexico policy, Vega will have to return to Mexico after she formally asks the U.S. for asylum. Martin Salgado worries temperatures are rising in the desert and there's no room left here.
No hay la infraestructura ni en Yuma ni en San Luis para atender esos flujos que se pretenden.
He says neither Yuma nor its neighboring Mexican town can handle a bigger bottleneck. Human Rights Watch says asylum seekers outnumber available beds 12 to 1, and many are left on the streets. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security beefed up infrastructure with those massive tents in Arizona, but the health and safety concerns it sought to avoid in the U.S. also fall on Salgado and the city of San Luis Rio Colorado to manage. For Here and Now, I'm Michel Marisco.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Emberwave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, own your temperature.
Actor and rapper Nora Lum, better known as her alter ego Awkwafina, had a breakout video in 2012 when she sang about her lady part. I'm not sure we can even play any of it. And then a breakout year in 2018 and with comic roles such as Constance, the pickpocket street hustler in Ocean's 8, Pak Lin, the over-the-top best friend in Crazy Rich Asians, who makes her first appearance in that film, bursting from a mansion to greet her friend Rachel, played by Constance Wu.
New York in the house!
Oh, Piglin!
What a bitch!
Oh my God, you look amazing.
I know, some things never change, right?
In Awkwafina's new film, there are laughs and tears, lots of them. She plays Billy, a Chinese-born girl raised in New York by parents who thought they were doing the right thing by bringing her here from China, and they think they're doing the right thing by traveling back to China. For a remarkable ruse, the entire extended family gathers for a hastily thrown-together wedding, a guise to gather around Billy's beloved grandmother, Nai Nai, who doesn't know she has cancer and maybe just weeks to live. In this scene in New York, Awkwafina's father, played by Tai Ma, tells her of the plan.
I need to call her.
You can't do that.
I need to go see her.
You can't do that.
She doesn't know. The family thinks it's better not to tell her, so you can't say anything.
I don't understand. She doesn't have a lot of time left. She should know, right?
There's nothing they can do. So everyone decided it's better not to tell her.
And what's remarkable? This all happened. The Farewell is from writer-director Lulu Wang. It's based on her family. It opens in theaters tomorrow. It is terrific. So is Awkwafina, who joins us from New York. Or do you prefer Nora? What should we call you?
You can call me either. It's your call.
Or is it just Awk?
Call me that, please.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, because I understand your dad was Chinese-American, your mom Korean, and you're playing a character who's going back to China, you know, mm-hmm. after spending years in New York. That must have just resonated for you.
Oh, yeah. A lot of things resonated for me in this movie. I think the biggest one is my relationship with my grandma. I was raised by her. Yeah. My mom, who was South Korean, passed when I was 4. I was raised by my paternal grandma, and, you know, she was Chinese. And so when, you know, I first got this script, it resonated in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And for me personally, it was definitely a departure from a lot of my past roles. But a lot of that had to do with actually confronting things, you know, mm-hmm. like for maybe the first time in my life, huh. This role caused me to preemptively confront the death of my own grandma, which I've always thought about.
Yeah.
And I think it taught me to be vulnerable in ways that I really haven't been.
What tension for you, because here you are playing a character who's not allowed to share mm-hmm. these feelings of grief with this beautiful Chinese actress who plays your grandmother. And meanwhile, you just told us you're struggling to maybe feel some grief about your real grandmother.
Yeah, exactly. It's stifled a bit. You know, Billy is obviously loosely based on something that actually happened to Lulu. But Lulu was never like, I want her played this way, study me. It was never that. And there is me in there, but it's a role that eventually came to be like a vessel for the Asian American experience. Because a lot of people have to do this. When you see a family in this, your family in this context, you have to make the decision whether to greet them with sadness or to greet them with joy. It always is like a matter of like how different families deal with grief. You know, everyone does it in their own way, but it also for Billy, it is a period of growth for her yeah. because she goes back to learn that her way is not the right way, always.
You said as a child, when your mom first passed, you're the little one and you became a fixture of sorrow, you know, almost a mm-hmm. totem. Family members would come up to you and cry and you didn't like that. And maybe that's part of why you began to turn toward comedy. You wanted some joy. Your yeah. character travels from New York to China, where the entire sensibility about death is we're not different. Going to talk about it.
Yep.
We've talked to author Gish Jen about East-West cultural differences. She says Americans place emphasis on the development of the individual. Asians see mm-hmm. themselves in relation to the society. There's almost that exact conversation from the person who plays your uncle in the film.
Yeah, it stems from wanting to literally take a burden that shouldn't belong to someone that you love. Mm-hmm. And it also stems from this concept called filial piety, which is like, you never hear of it unless it's in the context of like East Asian culture. And it is just this undying respect for your elders, for your ancestors. Mm-hmm. It's something that Asian American people have. But along with that, they also have elements of resentment and obviously guilt.
Well, what your uncle says to you is you want, and your character does really very much want to tell your grandmother, shouldn't she know? She should know she doesn't mm-hmm. have much time. And he says that's to make you feel better. We're taking on the burden of knowing so that she doesn't have to know. So we're going to feel worse, but that's the way it goes. And by the way, I should say, this is a very heavy subject, but it's hilarious.
Farcical.
Yeah. What was it like for you there? I mean, because your character speaks of, I don't know who I am, and I, you know, I don't know where I belong, and am I speaking correctly? How about you?
Yeah, my Chinese is not perfect. Like, I did not grow up in a Chinese-speaking household. But at the same time, there is a very personal journey that occurs when you are Asian American in this country and you go back to Asia. You know, you always feel like you are an outsider in America, but when you go there, you really understand how much of an outsider you are. Yet, you have history there, and you can't forget that. As an actor, that happened for me. But I think that also, I know what it's like to go and meet someone, a family members that may live in another country that you can't communicate with, but the love is there. And like trying to make them laugh and stuff like that. And I think that's what Billy's trip was trying to convey, the joy that you feel when you see your family. And maybe you can't communicate with them properly, but you still feel the love.
Yeah. I just want to detour for a second because, you know, we mentioned, you know, your career prior to this film, including your 2012 viral video.
I just want you to say it at some point.
About your lady part.
Yes.
4.5 million views. One woman throwing down about another, you know, comparing hers with another. Let's just listen to a little. My vag bounced like J-Lo's booty. Your vag like James Lipton's booty. And my vag, it's ornamental. Your vag is a 5-hour PBS special. Yo, my vag. What were you thinking?
Man, you know, there was a song that had a similar title that it was actually a cover of. A parody of, I should say, about male parts.
Right.
And it was a simple question of why don't women have one? And so that's what I don't know what I was thinking. I don't know.
Well, I was kind of thinking about your new film. Again, The Farewell, it kind of debunks the myth of the submissive Asian woman because here's this strong grandmother, the matriarch of the family. You said your grandma became the matriarch of yours. strong, somewhat vulgar at times, you know.
yes, she was.
Yeah. Well, and I'm wondering if doing something like that video was about throwing off some of those expectations of Asian women.
Well, yeah, I think that at that time, not a lot of Asian women presented themselves in that way. Mm. And very quickly after that, I was told various things, like I was very brave, you know, like, wow, you must have a lot of confidence, you know. Mm. But that's the truth. I think that I've always found truth in being shameless. I think that we are taught, you know, actual Asian Americans, the ones who grew up in this country, I think that we all grow up with very strong matriarchs. And I grew up with one. And that stereotype or that example of like who we actually grew up with influences us more as people than like who we are fed in or portrayed in the media. And my grandma always nurtured like what other people would label weird. She told me that was the best part. Mm-hmm. And ever since I was like a very young child, so she always believed in me. And I think that, you know, if she didn't see, let me like explore that aspect of my personality, Awkwafina would never have been formed.
Look, you know, maybe doing a role or a video in defiance of an expectation of you. But then I'm wondering, sure, if there's also a burden to get it right.
Of course, yeah. We do, as Asian Americans, owe something back to our community. Not in a way that it's like if we make something great and it blows up in the box office, but morally, right? And I think that if we're given right now in 2019 the platform to tell our stories, let's do so with truth, with authenticity, and also with being uniquely ourselves, because we're not all the same. And we have different stories. We come from different places. And so I think that there is always going to be that responsibility because there's just not that much.
Well, and on the other hand, I just should say that while there's something very specific to the Chinese culture, this idea of throwing a huge wedding just to, you know, say goodbye to grandma without telling her that she has a terminal illness, that may be specific, but I wept.
Oh, there's so much truth. No matter what race you are, what you are, you will connect to this because it's we all experience loss, yeah, and we all experience love, whether it's a grandma or family, you know, and we know what that's like and we know what it's like to lose it.
There is an image, and it, to me, it's one of the saddest images in the world, no matter where it is. The receding image of an elder from the back, mm-hmm, of the car as you drive away.
Oh, man.
It's killer.
It is a wrecker.
And we're not going to give away the ending, except to say there will be a snapback, what, just before the credits.
There will be.
Yes. Awkwafina, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. This was lovely.
And what is also so lovely about the film The Farewell is this score by Alex Weston. He is the former assistant to Philip Glass, breaking out on his own, and we're going to meet him next week. But try to see The Farewell before then with Awkwafina. It's here and now.
France's legislature approved a new law today that will levy a 3% tax on big American tech companies like Google and Amazon. The tax is aimed at addressing a new reality of the digital age, that while a company like Google has customers who live in France, Google can base its European operations in a country like Ireland and pay its taxes there where they are lower. The French tax is already angering officials in the United States who are warning of trade consequences. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hello, Jeremy.
So it is not just France, Spain, the UK, even the EU altogether are considering similar measures. What are these European countries hoping to achieve?
Liberté, égalité, revenue, eh? Really?
That's revenue is probably a French word to begin with.
I took Spanish. This is a continuation of, you know, here in the United States, you remember the cat and mouse chase of localities, states trying to capture tax revenue lost to online shopping. You used to have what we thought of was like an Amazon arbitrage in so many states in the U.S. until lawmakers came around to realizing it was a tax dodge and they sued to recoup lost revenue. So now this is happening writ international.
So already the U.S. has indicated that it could respond to this 3% tax in France with trade consequences, tariffs maybe. What's the U.S. saying?
Yeah, big tech, these guys like Apple, Facebook, Google, it's the closest thing we have right now to national champions in 2019. They're dominant multinationals.
Except for the women's soccer team. Those are
That's true. That's true. Yeah. That's indeed. Right. They rake in tens of billions of dollars in high margin sales. So everybody wants to get their mitts on taxation. But that's vexed lawmakers here that companies like Facebook and Amazon could warehouse windfall profits abroad in low tax places like Ireland. And the Treasury Department is worried, I'm going to quote, what seems to be a fraying around the edges of the international consensus on how international taxation rights should be allocated, close quote. So then it becomes an issue of sovereignty versus who gets dibs on those windfall profits.
And I know that some tech companies are also worried that they could be taxed twice because of taxes like the one in France.
Right. But the question then is how you allocate. Say if you're a UK Facebook user who eyeballs a Facebook or Instagram ad, but you know, that otherwise pays nothing. How is that sale recognized? These cash flow statements that you see by Facebook, by Apple, by Amazon, by Google, they're very fluid. They're very international. Up till now, you know, you've allowed your accountants to game the system and pull and underreport opportunistically in pursuit of the best rates. The question is, how do you do revenue recognition? Where was that money realized? Was it in the data mining? Was it in the ad that was purchased beforehand? Was that provided by the customer who is otherwise not paying a subscription? It is vexingly difficult.
I want to ask you about one more thing in the news today. Amazon announced today it is going to spend about $7,000 per worker to retrain a third of its domestic workforce by 2025. That is 100,000 employees. Why is Amazon doing this?
You know, we saw a stat by Manpower Group that says companies investing in training their current employees, the fraction is going to jump from 54% last year to 84% by next year. And I think if you look at it, you think about automation, artificial intelligence, the bar is just being yanked up in terms of what even the most entry-level service worker is going to have to know to remain in the game. Companies are going to demand Inspector Gadget-like abilities. You know, are you able to code some? Can you speak a second language? Draw blood, perform CPR, record podcasts?
You'll have to do it all, I guess, at Amazon. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks.
Always my pleasure.
As of this month, Virginia residents must be 21 if they want to purchase tobacco products or e-cigarettes, unless they're in the military. Virginia's new law puts it in the same camp as 15 other states and Washington, D.C. that have raised the age to 21. Some pushback on the tobacco industry in a country with a long history of tobacco use. And for more on that history, let's go to historians Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, thanks.
Okay, so Nathan, tobacco is one of the great cash crops of U.S. agriculture. How early were there efforts to curb the power of the tobacco industry?
Well, first you have to appreciate that this is a big industry. We're talking chewing tobacco, pipe tobacco, cigars, and any part of this market can prove extremely lucrative and give you a lot of political power if you can corner it. Just to give you one quick example, cigarettes in 1900 are only 2% of the overall tobacco market. But the American Tobacco Company becomes one of the most powerful corporations in America by controlling this corner of this market. So the name that we associate with this is a man by the name of James Buchanan Duke. You may remember Duke University bearing the name, for example. And this company, under Duke's leadership, basically comes to control between 75 to 90% of all cigarette sales in the United States.
Wow.
I mean, it basically runs a Standard Oil kind of takeover of its competitors, you know, in the late 19th century. Now, of course, as the industry grows, progressive reformers emerge to try to curb the rise. And you have Midwestern activists like Lucy Page Gaston, who is known initially as part of the Women's Christian Temperance Movement, you know, regulating alcohol. They move in 1899 to try to basically curb cigarettes through the Anti-Cigarette League.
In 1899, she wanted to curb cigarettes. Wow.
That's right. And within 2 years, that organization goes from being founded to having over 300,000 members. Right. So there's already a population. And the argument is kind of fascinating because basically reformers see cigarettes as a moral vice that makes children delinquent. It emasculates men. It undersexes women. Mm. And we might think today about the all-American Marlboro man out west, but in the progressive era, cigarettes were basically an urban malady and a vice of wispy foreigners. So New Yorkers smoked cigarettes, or Dutchmen and Italians and Russians. You know, these were the folks who basically corrupted American society with their cigarettes. And so even even though the Anti-Cigarette League doesn't get a constitutional amendment, they are able to really help to fan new regulations across 15 states, and in some cases getting local regulations that even regulate women, preventing them from smoking cigarettes at the city level.
But it's interesting that they were not doing it for health reasons, not because it, you know, leads to lung cancer, but because it's a vice and it does all the other things that you just mentioned.
Exactly. Yeah, ruining the country in a moral and almost ethnic way.
Ruining the country. Okay. So, Ed, it's interesting that in Virginia, with this new law, the smoking age is going to be 21 unless you're in the military. So tell us a little bit about the history of the connections between smoking and members of the military.
Well, if you got them, smoke them. And in World War I, the U.S. Soldiers did have them. And matter of fact, the U.S. government decided that they would give tobacco rations and rolling papers to soldiers. And this is really the big takeoff of cigarettes. You know, Nathan was talking about the relatively effete reputation mm-hmm. of cigarettes before. Nothing like going with our men to the front in World War I to right. remove that symbol. And General John Pershing, commander of the American forces, said, look, tobacco is as important as food. Tobacco as much as bullets, and he says. And you may remember, you may break out in song, remembering the wartime classic, Don't Be a Slacker, Send Some Tobacco.
One of my favorites.
It is. Well, you know, it's great. And it was seen as a great sacrifice if you would, you know, send a cigarette for everyone you smoked to the guys in France. So tobacco companies, you'll be shocked to know, capitalized mm-hmm. on this patriotic connection, and they were eager to sell cigarettes and associate it not with being foreign, like Nathan was saying, mm-hmm. all those Dutchmen and Italians, but rather Americans. So as America has really switched into high production in the 20s, cigarettes were seen as all American as, well, cigarettes.
Well, and that brings us to the New Deal, where tobacco was actually supported by the government.
Right, right. I mean, by 1930, you know, you have cigarettes basically now being 40% of all tobacco products, right? So a massive explosion, which means they represent a critical corner of the economy that needed saving during the Great Depression. And so you have the New Deal's Agricultural Adjustment Administration, or the AAA, which basically tries to ensure prosperity for tobacco producers. And in the New Deal's first 3 years, tobacco producers received between $180 million and $250 million every year, right? So they're paying tobacco producers to make less, to stabilize prices, and as with many of these agricultural adjustments, it leads to mass evictions and really the decimation of a lot of poorer farmers across the South. And so there is a consequence that's a little bit unforeseen. And of course, then you have, you know, after World War II, there's oftentimes a conversion that we see in urban areas where people are focusing on expanding consumption. So again, getting the government behind encouraging people to go ahead and take a puff. And you have lobbyists who initially are part of the New Deal, who then joined K Street lobbying groups in the 1940s. And it becomes another way of using the American military or foreign policy to now extend American tobacco products into the former battlefronts of Europe that are now destroyed. So another example of military or a kind of federal underwriting of the tobacco economy.
So Ed, take us to the more recent history when people start to see the connections between tobacco and cancer. How does that start to impact the industry?
Well, you know, people aren't fools. They can see that if you smoke, it has these consequences. But the tobacco industry really mobilized in the early 1950s to really create the impression that smoking was good for you. I remember as a kid, doctors in ads and things telling you that smoking was good for you, helped your voice and so forth.
Wow.
And the Tobacco Industry Research Committee, which is a great circumlocution, from the mid-1950s until the late 1990s, actually spends hundreds of millions of dollars on so-called smoking and health research to mislead the public, in fact. You know, in the early 1960s, there's a big campaign to label cigarettes, but the lobby is very strong then and just points out that cigarette smoking may hurt your health. Right. Not, in fact, as the record show, did hurt your health.
You know, we laugh about the idea of doctors supporting cigarette smoking, but I saw an ad recently where a smartphone was advertising that it had a battery so long that a little kid could fall asleep still watching their smartphone, which maybe 50 years from now right. we'll look back and say that might not have been such a great thing to promote. Let's go to today then, Nathan. Only 15% of Americans smoke cigarettes compared with 46% who smoked mid-century. Those numbers have come way down.
Well, the first thing you have to think about is, you know, very much in keeping with other movements in the 1960s and early 70s, there's actually a moment when people begin to see themselves as non-smokers, right? And so, you know, people who are trying to fight back tuberculosis, emphysema, heart disease, it becomes part of changing the national consciousness about cigarettes.
Now, just as we're making these strides, we are seeing a big rise in the amount of people who are smoking e-cigarettes, especially teens in this country. Now, the e-cigarette makers are going to say, well, you know, this is a good way for people to quit smoking traditional cigarettes. But, Ed, I mean, we're seeing a trend that's moving in the opposite direction of what we've been talking about.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. One out of five high school kids today smokes e-cigarettes. Mm. And we can remember not long ago when they didn't exist. So it's pretty amazing that's caught on that rapidly. And matter of fact, what you find is that a considerable number of middle school students are starting to do this as well. Mm. So you'll see if you recognize this theme. The industry is saying this is a good way to improve your health by getting off tobacco, but other advocates are saying, no, this is actually an easy way into nicotine addiction, which could lead to any other form of tobacco use. So, you know, it's we're caught in the same perpetual pattern that we've been for over 100 years now, where there's conflicting stories and conflicting arguments and evidence, but we seem to be still addicted to this nicotine.
Well, and I will say that one of the things that is also echoing history here is there's very little research at this point about e-cigarettes. We went and visited one of the FDA-funded research operations in Kentucky looking into e-cigarettes, and one thing that they're finding is that it may not cause lung cancer, but cardiovascular issues are being seen already in e-cigarette use because of all the particles in there. But anyway, we'll link to that at hereandnow.org. Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Remember that dire warning recently from the UN panel on climate change that countries need to take unprecedented action within about a decade to control the worst effects of climate change, including swaths of uninhabitable land? Okay, well, how about planting trees? Lots of them. Over a trillion. Researchers out of Switzerland say that over the course of time, these extra trees would capture more than 800 billion tons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Thomas Crowther is co-author of the study. He's a climate change ecologist at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. Professor Crowther, Tom, take us back to, what, fourth grade? Why do trees take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and what is the problem with too much in it?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. So I guess, you know, humans have been burning fossil fuels, which has released a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which is causing the greenhouse gas effect, and it's warming our planet. But the nice thing is trees, as we know, photosynthesize, and that means they capture carbon from the atmosphere and suck it down into their trunks and in the roots, and then they even pump it into the soil. So we've always known that they have the potential to be our allies in this battle.
Well, it's interesting because humans have been trying to replicate what trees do with carbon capture, with technology that can suck carbon out of the atmosphere and then store it into the ground. But as you're saying, trees already do it.
That's exactly right. Trees are doing it fantastically. Now, I'm not trying to discourage all of the brilliant technological advances, but we've already got huge amount of space available for trees. And if we can restore trees on those lands, 0.9 billion hectares is available for us to restore trees. And if we restored them and they grew to full mature forests, they would capture a major chunk of that excess carbon that's in the atmosphere and really help us in that fight against climate change.
Okay, so two things there. First of all, you indicated don't stop with the technology, and you also say don't stop with emissions, that planting the trees really doesn't work unless we really also, on the other side, cut emissions.
That is such an important point. We have to cut emissions. But at the moment, we've still got loads and loads of carbon that's already accumulated in the atmosphere. And so trees could be a really powerful one to capture that existing carbon in combination with those cuts to emissions.
Okay, talk about where you think those trees could go.
So it's amazing. We thought it would be focused in certain parts of the world. But what's amazing is these degraded ecosystems, these places where trees should naturally be, are distributed all over the world. So every country can really play its part. Now, I would stress that the best countries are often in the tropics, because those are places that trees go really quickly and they suck up the most carbon. But really, we can all play a part in this, whether it's governments or just us.
Well, you've said that Russia, the United States, Canada, Australia, Brazil, China have the most room. But speaking of room, people have questioned, well, what about what that land can also be used for, which is growing food or places for people to live?
That is another really important consideration. So, of course, we have to have land, first urban land for humans to live, and second agricultural land to support our growing population. And that's why we made sure that we focused on areas that we are not using. We excluded those urban and agricultural areas.
So how do you see this happening? I mean, what kind of response have you had from governments? This costs money. You got to find saplings somewhere, I would imagine. I mean, how does it work?
That's a good point. The nice thing about this as a solution is it's really low tech. It doesn't need a politician to make a decision, and it doesn't need a scientist to come up with some new invention. All it needs is all of us getting involved. And genuinely, since we've released this information, there has been a mass wave of people starting planting trees all over the place and also donating loads of money to the thousands of restoration projects that are already doing a great job in restoring trees around the world.
Well, that's good to hear, because, as you know, there's also been some gentle mocking, you know, on social media. Yeah, right, plant a tree, that'll change everything. You know, but you say what?
I find it enjoyable and hilarious. I mean, of course, we've always known this. It's like the hippie solution, plant a tree, save the world. But the amazing thing is now we've got the science to back it up. It really is this unbelievably powerful tool.
I am looking at some of the social media comments. Finally, I guess there was a reaction to people planting trees in a town in Canada. People were against the trees for some reason, and somebody writes, finally, somebody willing to stand up against big canopy.
So as with every story, there's always, you know, the bigger the story, the bigger the naysayers. And so, of course, there's going to be people who like other solutions, and that's great. That's the part of it. We want every climate change solution. We want to encourage everyone to do whatever they want. And all we're saying is that for any of those people who are interested in having that tangible impact, there's something that all of us can get involved with. And it's a really nice, simple way to get connected to nature as well.
Thomas Crowther is co-author of the study that concluded that planting trees enough to cover, well, the size of the United States, over a trillion of them, could be the best, most efficient, and cheapest way to really fight climate change. Thomas, again, we'll try to link to some of these organizations that are doing just what you say. Thank you so much.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.